to Envision This, connecting you to visionaries of a more resilient, equitable, and earth-friendly future. You're welcome not only as a listener, but as a participant, if you're listening live now. To participate, please call 646-652-2235. This is Mary Hall, and here with me is Burl Hall, my co-host. Our guest, Storm Cunningham, envisions this, a path to revitalizing our economy, restoring our environment, and renewing the quality of our lives. He inspires evidence-based optimism about the future of our world as an author, speaker, consultant, and magazine publisher. His evidence is based on the growth of projects, programs, disciplines, and technologies that are currently revitalizing communities, restoring natural resources, and boosting economic and social resilience. Storm's online magazine, Revitalization News, is a resource for regenerative leaders, entrepreneurs, and students. So please help me to welcome Storm Cunningham.
Thank you, Mary. Hello, girl.
Hey, how you doing, Storm?
Good. That's wonderful.
Good. Storm, what do you see as the way to revitalize our economy before the powers that be march us off into an even deeper, steeper cliff?
Well, there are so many different aspects to that. You know, it really depends on who I'm talking to at any given time when they ask me a question like that. You know, if I'm talking to a civil engineer, I'll talk about infrastructure renewal, you know, how, you know, our infrastructure in this country especially is just falling apart. I mean, you probably saw the article yesterday about how the people in Flint, Michigan are getting poisoned by their drinking water, and that's actually not a rare circumstance. And, the whole, you know, a good, healthy economy is one with minimal friction. And good infrastructure is what reduces friction, enables goods to move efficiently and people to communicate efficiently and people to get the resources they need to live healthfully, like water and energy. So infrastructure is a major part of it. But then if I'm talking to a community activist, I'll probably talk more about how more inclusive planning and visioning for the community is the key to revitalizing the economy. If I'm talking to a restoration ecologist, I'll probably talk about watershed restoration or ecosystem restoration and all the ways that our natural resources can feed our economy, oftentimes by reconnecting them or reconnecting cities to the natural environment. So there's no short answer to that question.
Well, probably much of our listenership is in the second category of activists. I'm guessing there, but given the nature of most of our programs, I'm guessing that's the audience you're talking to right now. What do you mean by evidence-based optimism?
Well, as a professional speaker, I'm pretty familiar with the kinds of folks that are hired to keynote conferences, and most conferences, when they choose a keynote speaker, they're really looking for an entertainer who's got just enough content to justify their presence as a learning experience. I position myself for general conferences as a professional optimist, but I do specify the evidence base to distinguish myself from the more kind of rah-rah cheerleading that gets people, you know, into an emotional high. But, you know, when they think back on the message 2 days later, they can't remember what was said or why they should be happy. So what I do is tell them stories. I show them before and after photographs of dramatic examples of how communities have come back to life or natural resources have been brought back to life. And they don't forget those pictures. They don't forget the stories.
You make us wish that we were a visual medium. Can you give us some examples and words of actions people are taking that, you know, have a dramatic before and after effect?
Wow, there are so many different forms. You know, for instance, I got into this whole field back in the mid-90s as a result of scuba diving on a reef that was being brought back to life in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jamaica's reefs are 99% dead now. And back then there was this fellow named Wolf Hilberts who was inventing a technology called BioRock, that where you put a floating solar panel on the, you know, it's floating on the ocean there. They run two little wires down to a form made of chicken wire. And they put the positive lead on one end and the negative on the other end. And that tiny, tiny little bit of electricity passing through the chicken wire causes calcium carbonate, which is, you know, the solid stuff of reefs, to aggregate on the wire. And very, very, you know, it accelerates it. So it's pulling this calcium and this carbon out of the water, which is needed these days because the oceans are becoming more acidic. So the more carbon you pull out of the water, the healthier the water is. And very quickly, the ocean life, the corals, the fish, everything, you know, the algae starts aggregating on there. And in a very, very short period of time, a year or less, you've got a very healthy ecosystem going there. And it's just amazing, you know, the life, you know, that the life in the ocean is always desperate to find a new home. And we've been destroying so much of it that when they find a place like that, they populate it very quickly. And when I saw that, I was actually down there helping him because I'm a lifelong scuba diver and he needed some volunteers to help put these units in place. And when I saw that, it suddenly hit me, wow, you know, just sustaining, you know, just doing less damage, you know, and greening up what we're already doing is wonderful stuff, but we're, the world is just too far gone to rely on slowing down the rate at which we damage it. You know, we that's what we should have been doing 300 years ago. You know, now we need to focus on undoing the damage, you know, restoring what we've damaged along the way. I mean, you look around at the devastation and depletion and the fragmentation of our planet, and you got to say, who wants to sustain this mess?
Right, right. I agree with you. There are times when it seems like maybe our species ought to go extinct so that the world can thrive. But obviously, you're coming across examples where things that people do actually can help revitalize. Can you give us another example? That one was wonderful.
Well, it depends on, you know, how people are doing it, because there are so many different aspects. As I mentioned before, some people are revitalizing through social activities, you know, because sometimes a community has everything it needs to come back to life, but the people just aren't working together. You know, like up in Hamilton, Ontario, that city, I've been telling folks in Canada for the last decade that Hamilton has got the greatest revitalization potential of any city in Canada. It's just on this perfect peninsula surrounded by water. It's close to the Toronto area, so it can hitchhike on that economy. It's got Niagara Falls, you know, south of it. You know, it's got all the connections, all the assets. It's got beautiful old buildings. It's got everything it needs to revitalize. But they've had trouble on a community engagement and political level for a long, long time, just working together. So sometimes simply the human aspect is all that's needed to revitalize. Other times you have to get involved in much more physical projects. And one of those examples of physical projects that you'll find in almost any older city is reusing, repurposing, restoring historic buildings. Because in most communities these days, it's the downtown that suffered. You know, we've done so much sprawl development and big box stores out in the middle of nowhere that our downtowns have been devitalized. And the downtowns have an asset that the suburbs don't have, which is these historic buildings. And people love to be around physical beauty, to beautiful architecture. So there's been a tremendous growth over the last 20 years of both for-profit and non-profit and government-based projects to restore these old buildings, find new purposes for them. My mantra these days is basically three words: repurpose, renew, reconnect. Those are the three things that you'll find in almost all successful revitalization efforts, whether they're rural or urban or just natural resource-based. In many cases, we've got assets. You know, look at the High Line Park in New York City, you know, this old elevated railway. They were going to spend tens of millions of dollars to tear it down, and local citizens had a beautiful idea of repurposing it into a park. And so what you find is when you find a new purpose for an old asset, then the money becomes available to renew it. And the most powerful renewal projects are those that reconnect communities or reconnect neighborhoods or reconnect natural resources. And you put those three things together, repurposing, renewing, and reconnecting, and places can come back to life in the most dramatic way.
What stumbling blocks do big bankers place in their way?
In their own way or in the way of communities?
In the way of communities.
Yeah.
Most of the big bankers these days, you know, aren't locally focused. You know, traditionally you had savings and loans, you know, that did most of their lending to the community and had a very strong sense of community. And savings and loans have gone into tremendous decline. So you end up with just these huge multinational banks that really aren't connected to the community. They're basically just in many cases, operating in an almost parasitic mode on the economy.
What other stumbling blocks do you encounter when trying to encourage a community or a company or a nation or whatever it is to take on this kind of restorative project? What do you find is the most difficult thing to overcome?
Well, probably the most common one, and this is the one that I usually get brought in to address, is that many places have been trying to bring themselves back to life for decades. And you get a negativity, a pessimism, especially amongst the longtime residences. You know, where somebody talks about how they can revitalize their downtown or revitalize their region, and they just said, "Ah, yeah, we've tried that before; it doesn't work." And so, I come in and I've got two messages that that address that directly. One is that my role is to show them what's happening in other places that are very similar to them and how they overcame that pessimism. You know, and that's where the evidence-based optimism comes in. You know, the just showing them what's possible, especially in places that don't have much in the way of resources or money. And the other one is to make them aware of how important new arrivals are in the community. That it's often the people who have just moved to a community, especially immigrants, that are the ones who end up most involved in the revitalization of neighborhoods. You know, because they don't know what's happened before. All they can see is the possibilities.
Interesting, because we can see that in Lewiston, Maine, which is the city. I guess it qualifies as a city elsewhere. It certainly does in Maine, where there have been a number of immigrants. And for the most part, the old-time Mainers have kind of rejected or marginalized them. And yet, you do see shops and things popping up. And they've established, for instance, a urban farmer's market and so forth, which I don't know how far it's going to revitalize, but at least it's beginning to integrate these people into our community.
Oh, urban farmers markets are tremendous revitalizers for a number of reasons. One is that they reconnect the city to the rural economy, and that's something, you know, these local food systems, that's a tremendous growth strategy these days, is recreating local food systems so that People aren't just eating stuff that's been flown in from 5,000 miles away. That helps boost the urban and rural economy together. But it also, urban farmers markets are a wonderful way to activate dead properties, you know, old surface parking lots and places like that, you know, dead spots in the city are just, you know, farmers markets are wonderful ways to bring them back to life.
There's this horrible, just plain blank, not brick, but concrete wall behind where the Somalis have their farmers markets. And it's not just Somali, by the way. Other farmers bring things in to the city. But anyway, I wish that somebody would co-opt that wall and allow the Somalis to decorate it, to paint it, so that it would be a beautiful backdrop to the instead of such a collision of that, such a wall.
Yep. Yeah, painting ugly walls and buildings is also, strangely enough, a growth trend these days. I was just looking at some fantastic photos of a community down in Mexico that had had a lot of gang violence, and they repainted the entire town. So when you look at it from a distance, the whole thing looks like a spectrum, you know, a rainbow. It's just the most incredible thing.
Wow.
And it's doing wonderful things to revitalize the economy. You know, people really want to live there now, and violence has dropped tremendously just from paint.
I experienced that in Bermuda. They, you know, people aren't wealthy, but boy, are they happy and together. And it's because of all of the various colors that people have painted their little, you know. Mm-hmm. They keep them up too nicely to call them shacks, but you know they aren't very wealthy. But boy, there's a beauty there.
Yeah, beauty is one of the overlooked aspects of community revitalization. It's not just the historic buildings. You know, it's also greening. I've got three weeks worth of work coming up in Australia in September. You know, I'm keynoting a bunch of conferences for the Planning Institute of Australia and also for the Green Building Council of Australia. And Melbourne has just published a guide to creating urban forests that's really wonderful. You can download it. And this is another one of those trends, is that people are going beyond just simple streetscaping and potted plants to recreating urban forests. Many times urban forests that used to be there a century ago, but that got paved over. And that kind of greenery, that kind of connection between the urban and the natural environment, along with reconnecting to water, you know, lakes and streams and rivers, is another one of the most powerful urban revitalization trends.
We're going to be talking soon to some people in a little town in Maine called Norway, Maine, who have created an edible main street so that you can walk down the main street and not only look at the shops but also pick various fruits and vegetables and whatever and just snack as you're walking down the street.
Huh.
Lots of people say economy or ecology, and that we can't afford both. How would you answer these folks?
Well, the fact is, right now there's a report just came out from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, showing that ecological restoration is already a $9 billion a year economy in this country. We can actually make money, just as much money, if not more, from restoring our ecology as we did from destroying it in the first place. That's kind of the big transition we're going through right now. You've probably heard the term Anthropocene, you know, that we're in a new epoch where previous epoch, the Holocene, was defined by the point at which humankind started affecting the earth. You know, we started adapting the world to our needs. And now we've entered the Anthropocene, which is defined as the point at which human activities dominate the planet. And we need to move, you know, from what I call adaptive conquest, which is the mode we've been in for the last 12,000 years or so, to a mode I call adaptive renewal. So we're moving from an economy based on extracting virgin resources and developing raw land to an economy based on restoring natural resources and on redeveloping and revitalizing the places we've already developed.
That sounds almost like I write often for op-ed news, but it sounds like you're kind of keying into what I and the senior editor, Rob Connell, talks about, and that is kind of like developing a more bottom-up culture, more so than top-down. Am I hearing that correctly? Or?
Yeah, actually, that's something I've got in my upcoming third book, Resilient Prosperity, is that there are three modes of community revitalization, and all of them can work, but not all of them are appropriate at any given time or in any given place. You've got the top-down approach, which is the traditional one, which can work. You know, it can bring a lot of money to fix big problems. The trouble is that it tends to be rather autocratic, and if somebody has the wrong idea, they can do a tremendous amount of damage, as we saw in the 50s and 60s with the urban renewal debacle, where, you know, the federal government basically paid communities to destroy themselves. And you know, so that was a really bad idea. That was, you know, urban planners during those two decades did more economic damage to the United States than any foreign military has ever done. And many communities, you know, Hartford, Connecticut, Detroit, places like that, are still suffering from the effects. They're trying to come back to life, but they don't have the wealth of restorable buildings, you know, the historic buildings downtown anymore that other communities like Charleston have used to bring themselves back to life, because the urban planners in the 60s destroyed them all. You know, their philosophy back then was destroy it and they will come. And, you know, so they thought, well, if we just get rid of all these empty buildings and create big, wide, open spaces, they'll get filled in some magic, you know, through some magic principle. And that magic principle didn't work.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the top-down approach. You've got the bottom-up approach, which is, you know, kind of the neighborhood groups that see the need for something, whether it's a farmer's market or a community garden, or they just take on the restoration of a historic theater or whatever it might be, and that can work too. And then you've got what you could call more the emergent, the fixer approach, where individuals just emerge at the right place in the right time. Oftentimes they're private developers, they could be within city government, but it's more of, you could call it the hero approach, where individuals just seeing opportunities and acting on it. And my new book's got a lot of great stories there of these individual fixers who come in and make things happen. And sometimes that's what's needed in order to kind of keep a place going until it reaches a critical mass where revitalization suddenly takes off and doesn't need any external prompting. There's a guy down in Brooklyn, New York. He's a retired New York City detective. And he pretty much single-handedly has revitalized the Red Hook neighborhood of Brooklyn. After he retired, he just started buying up these empty waterfront buildings. And now he owns most of the buildings there, but the local people love him. It's not like he's this dominant mogul or anything. You know, he's doing really good things for the community.
Why is our ecological crisis just as important as our financial crisis?
Well, they're not two different crises. They're linked. You know, we're, you know, some economies, they're very closely linked. You know, over 10% of the world economy is based on fishing. So if you're talking about an island nation or coastal communities, you know, sometimes that's like 90% of their economy is based on the ocean. So you see, you know, tremendous impact when the ocean starts dying on their economy. But even in inland communities, where, you know, we're they've got a tremendous connection to the world's oceans, and you know, the and water is, you know, the key to any economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you see what's happening in California right now. A lot of that problem, I've been telling them for 15 years now, you know, when they've been complaining about all these wildfires that have been damaging their economy and hurting their rainfall, you know, because trees are the ultimate cloud makers. They're the ones that reach deep down into the earth and pull out the water and evaporate it into the air. And, you know, they, I've been telling them, you know, that those hills that burn every summer didn't used to do that 300 years ago, you know, before the Spanish came up from Mexico with their goats and sheep, and before the English settlers came over from the east with their plows and their cattle and devastated the natural ecology, and which then got replaced with invasive species. Those invasive species are the ones that turn brown in the summer and burn. If they were to ecologically restore those hills with the native species, they'd be green all year long, and they wouldn't have this problem.
Hmm. Interesting. And that would create more water for
exactly.
Oh, wow. You know, it's marvelous when you can see a positive cycle like that.
They did that down in Costa Rica. They came up with a very... they saw that the watershed around San Juan, the capital city, was being destroyed, and that people come to Costa Rica to see the wonderful rainforests, and the very first thing they see when they fly into San Juan are all these devastated hills. It makes a very bad first impression. Plus, the city of San Juan was running out of fresh water. They came up with an innovative water tax. They basically started getting people to pay more for the water they were receiving in San Juan, and then they took that money and put it into watershed restoration. And as a result, they've now got more water for a bigger population, and the hills around them are beautified again, and the place looks like the sort of place that people expect to see when they fly into Costa Rica.
Mm. How does the quality of life for humans converge with the ecological and economic, both the destruction that's been going on and the revitalization that you're suggesting?
Well, quality of life is really the key to attracting a good economy. You hear economic developers talk about how a company moved to their city as a result of all the freebies they offered, the free land or the 30 years of no taxes and that sort of thing. But if you talk to the companies that are building these new factories or relocating, they'll tell you, 9 times out of 10, they've already decided where they want to go before those things are even offered. They take advantage of all the freebies, but they already know where they want to go, because the most important thing to them is having a good quality of life for their employees, which means that they're also able to hire high-quality employees. It's hard to hire, no matter how much you pay a person, hire them to come to a city that's got bad schools, it's got high crime, that's ugly, and that's going downhill. Whereas even a place that's not looking that great at the moment can attract high-quality employees if everybody's got confidence in its future, that it's actually coming back to life. Because revitalizing places are cool. Everybody loves to be in a neighborhood or a community that's coming back to life.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the quality of life issues that you think our current trajectory, you know, dominant trajectory, are damaging?
Well, you know, a lot of it gets down to fragmentation, that a lot of communities have the resources to have a better quality of life, but people don't have access to them. You know, we spent most of the 18th and 19th centuries turning our waterfronts, whether on the ocean or on rivers, into industrial zones. You know, which made sense at the time. You know, that's you were exporting your natural resources, your lumber, your coal, or whatever, through the ports on the waterfront, and you're bringing in shiploads of merchandise, and it made sense to warehouse them there on the waterfront. But as those economies died, we ended up with these waterfronts that were not only ugly, usually crime-ridden, But they're also separated from the city by urban highways, because at that time the urban planners figured, okay, well, if this is a dead zone anyway, let's just stick a highway on top of it. And now that doesn't make sense anymore. People want to reconnect to their water. So there's this huge trend, hundreds of billions of dollars a year are being spent all around the world now tearing down these urban highways. I mean, I think the city of Seoul in South Korea is tearing down, I think, 9 or maybe 10 urban highways right now. They're pretty much the world leader in this trend. And probably the most famous one that got it all started was the Chonggishon stream restoration. They had this ancient stream that ran through Seoul that people had been reading about in their stories, you know, their children's stories, and for thousands of years. And back in the 50s, they paved it over and turned it into a huge multi-lane urban highway. And that highway separated the neighborhoods. People couldn't just visit or shop with people they used to be able to, because the highway was in the way. And it reduced real estate values, because nobody wanted to live or work right next to this noisy, dirty highway. And this fellow ran for mayor about 15 years ago and said, if you elect me mayor, I'll tear down that highway and restore the stream that used to be there. And people loved the idea. They elected him mayor. He did exactly that. It's now this beautiful greenway with a stream running through it that runs right through the heart of Seoul, that reconnects the neighborhoods and provides this wonderful green, refreshing quality of life experience. It's brought the downtown back to life in a tremendous way and boosted real estate values tremendously all around it, just like the High Line did in Manhattan. And as a result of that success, he got elected president of South Korea.
Wow. I'm just curious. In the States, I hear people balking at that sort of thing, and I'm all with it, but I'm just going to ask their question. Is that, you know, how does that help the economy? Which scenario?
Well, it gets back to what I mentioned before about the friction thing, that the easier it is for things to move around, whether it's individuals or commercial trucks or whatever, the more efficient an economy is. But it's also a matter of that reconnecting to the quality of life. You know, if people have a river there, like Charles River in Boston, but they can't get to it, you know, then it doesn't add much to their quality of life unless they're flying over. You know, for instance, the Big Dig. You know, everybody reviled the Big Dig as this just huge, wasteful, corrupt project. You know, that was, you know, billions of dollars that disrupted Boston for, you know, well over a decade. And it's true. It was inefficiently implemented. There was a lot of corruption going on. But the fact is, the underlying idea was to reconnect the city, get rid of all these highways that were separating the community, reconnect neighborhoods, reconnect the people to their water, you know, recreate a bunch of green spaces and parks along the water. You know, the basic idea was wonderful, and it's paying off big time. You know, Boston is really starting to come back to life now, and it's very much as a result of the Big Dig.
Are you familiar with Lackawanna, just south of Buffalo?
Yeah, I've done some work in Buffalo, and I've been through Lackawanna, but I can't say I'm really familiar with it that much.
I was wondering, you know, if you were to start advising them how you, because they have so few economic resources with which to deal with those empty steel plants, you know, and so forth.
Well, hopefully there'll be some spillover from Buffalo. You know, they'll see what has been happening there, because, you know, Buffalo, as I'm sure you know, has been trying for decades to revitalize itself. It used to be one of the major cities in the country, and it's now became a bit of a backwater, lost a lot of population, partly due to industrial changes, partly due to railroads taken over from canals, and partly due to some very bad urban planning. But they're reversing that now. They've got wonderful waterfront revitalization projects going on, you know, reusing the old silos. They've got a wind farm on the waterfront, and they've restored a historic canal. They're putting tons of residential. They did it a little backwards. They did the commercial redevelopment first and then the residential. It's usually better to do the residential first. But either way, it's starting to pay off. And downtown Buffalo, especially the waterfront, is finally coming back to life successfully.
Is what you're talking about now what you label adaptive renewal?
Well, the adaptive part is more related to the process, you know, the planning. Too many places, they take a very rigid approach to planning. And they'll say, okay, now we're going to come up with a 15-year plan or whatever, and, you know, they'll pay somebody a couple $100,000 to come up with the plan, and then they just stick with the plan for the next 15 years, no matter what changes might be happening in the overall economy or what changes happen in the city. And what we need is more of a living document. We need a more adaptive approach. And there's a discipline called adaptive management, which actually evolved out of the restoration ecology movement, where people who are restoring ecosystems had to acknowledge the fact that we don't know enough about how ecosystems really work to say that this approach is going to restore it. So they came up with this adaptive approach, which they call adaptive management, where they learn as they go and they adjust their approach as they go. If something doesn't seem to be working and they learn something new about how that ecology works, then they adapt it into the plan, they change it, and that kind of living, evolving, constantly evolving approach is now starting to spill over to the more intelligent communities who realize, hey, we don't really understand how a community works. You know, a community is a complex adaptive system, and we're only just starting to get some insights into how complex adaptive systems work, whether they're human or economic or ecological. So let's not just assume we know what this community needs ahead of time. Let's get a vision and start working towards that vision. But as far as the strategies and tactics, let's stay flexible.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. Can you explain and expand on your formula, revitalization plus resilience plus adaptive management equals adaptive renewal?
You know, a lot of the, there's a lot of focus on resilience these days. You know, it's kind of the hot new term. A lot of people are getting tired of sustainable or getting tired of, you know, green or whatever, have adopted resilience. You know, it's a fresh dialogue, and it seems to be a bit healthier when you're dealing with a world that's as dysfunctional and broken as ours is today. And it was climate change, I think, that was the primary impetus behind this resilience approach, that people realized it's not enough just to grow economically. We now need, especially in coastal communities, we now need to recognize that we're going to get hit with storms more frequently than before. We're going to get hit with stronger storms than before. We're getting hit with sea level rise. And, you know, we need to figure out how to recover more quickly from these disasters. We need to figure out how to design ourselves to minimize the damage when these things happen. So this is all part of the resilience movement. The key now is to take that resilience goal and connect it to revitalization. Because just because we're focused on climate change and disasters and resilience doesn't mean that the communities don't need revitalization anymore. So when we combine our work on revitalizing the community with our work towards resilience, and we do it in an adaptive manner, because this is very complex. So, you know, rather than trying to figure out ahead of time, you know, let's just move as we go. And part of this is we need to realize that most places do things backwards. You know, they don't understand the relationship between planning and strategy and projects. They'll just dive right into projects. You know, money becomes available, some big developer comes to town, or a federal grant comes along, and communities just jump into a project, saying, oh, let's build a new convention center, let's build a new sports arena. And the fact is that a project is simply a way of implementing a plan, and a plan is how you implement a strategy, and a strategy is how you implement a vision. So if you're jumping into a project without a plan, or if you're implementing a plan that was created without a strategy for it to implement, or if you've got a strategy that isn't driven by a vision of where you actually want to go, you know, you're building on a bed of sand.
Wow. We have a caller. Caller from area code 609. Would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Dave.
Hi, Dave. And
hi.
What did you want to add to our discussion?
Oh, just one question, and that is, how could we help kids get their education embedded with revitalization as a dominant focus, or at least a good focus?
Well, wonderful question. That's really the key, and it's one of the areas that I'm starting to focus on more personally, is realizing that, you know, I've been doing this now full-time for over a dozen years, and I started researching it back in the mid-90s, and I found that it's very, very difficult for institutions, whether they're government or business or nonprofit, to change. You know, they really, you know, if they've already defined themselves as being about sustainability, they don't want to hear about having to change to revitalization or regeneration or whatever. And it's the same with government agencies. You know, they get their funding for a specific purpose. Oh, we're all about planning. We're all about public works. We're all about economic development. And that's what they get their funding for. And they say, well, yeah, it'd be great to do these other things and take a more integrative approach, but yeah, that's not in our silo. We're just about this. So what we need is to start changing the way people expect to affect the world. And that needs to happen at a younger age. You know, kids don't get any education these days that talks about what I call restorative careers. I've done these symposia at universities all around the country, you know, Harvard and Clemson and University of Virginia and University of Maryland, University of Texas. I've done these symposia on restorative careers, and they are packed to the gills. You know, faculty and students alike, just, you know, they just love the idea that their career might not just be green, might be non-destructive, but that they could actually have a career where they're earning their living, bringing the planet back to life. And the only way to raise their sights like that, to make them realize, wow, you know, I don't have to settle for an ordinary career. I can actually, you know, revitalize our world as a career. The only way that kind of expectation, that kind of aspiration is going to get into their heads is if it gets into their heads early, you know, so that's what they expect their life to the effect they their life is going to have on the world. So I'd love to start creating a series of videos, for instance, you know, kind of like the Khan Academy with their original mathematics videos. Create a series of videos that kids can watch in the school, you know, showing people bringing places back to life and, you know, getting those stories into their heads so that it raises their expectations.
Maybe giving them projects. I mean, in a way, school gardens does a little bit of that. But how, even at an earlier level than the university level, would you get kids thinking in terms of resilience and revitalization and adaptation?
Well, yeah, I think you hit on probably the most powerful single way, which is getting them involved in a project. You know, for instance, up in Baltimore, which is connected, it's at the very top of the Chesapeake Bay, they've got a project there in their schools where during the winter the kids grow seagrasses in the classroom. And in the spring, they go out into the dead spots of Chesapeake Bay, places that have lost their seagrasses, which are absolutely critical to all kinds of life, you know, the blue crabs, the fish, you know, the birds. You know, the seagrasses are essential to the ecology there. And the kids go out and physically plant these seagrasses that they've grown in the classroom. And, you know, just imagine for a second, you know, you're a 9-year-old, you know, from the inner city, and you go back out to one of these sites a year later, you know, and you remember that when you went out there before, it was just this ugly mud flat, you know, with virtually no life in it. And now you go back to that spot, and it's lush and it's green. There are birds and butterflies and crabs and horseshoe crabs and, you know, fish all over the place. And you look at that and you say, wow, I did this. I brought the world back to life. You know, what kind of effect is that going to have on a kid's psyche?
Yeah.
That's wonderful, because I spent most of my life actually in Baltimore. And I remember when working in the inner city, some of the folks that I worked with, you know, if you talk to them about going out into buildings, they'd say, oh my God, no. But when they get the positive experience of it, and that's exactly what you're bringing forth to these kids or whatever. And, you know, you're doing a gold mine of good for both the kid and the planet herself.
Yep. Yeah, that's why the subtitle of our magazine, Revitalization News, is, our renewed future. Evidence for optimism, resources for action. It's not enough to have optimism if you don't know what to do next.
Jack.
Or what you can do. But it's also not enough to have tools or money if you don't really have any belief that the future is savable.
You talk a lot about resilient prosperity. How do you contrast that from the kind of unending growth of our current economic thinking, which is...
A lot of the so-called prosperity you see, measured on a quarterly basis, especially in this country, isn't much different from a drug high, which is very similar to our agriculture. We get these huge crops, that have been artificially stimulated with chemicals, but they're not very healthy. The soil is dead. There's little microbial action in there to provide all the micronutrients. So you get, tomatoes that look like tomatoes, but there's really not much in there, and spinach that looks like spinach, but has, 1/1,000th the nutrition of organic spinach. And so we see the same dynamic in our economy, where you get all this artificial stimulation of jobs, for instance. And oftentimes, it's a Walmart, there's slave labor jobs. The only way people can survive on the salary is by getting government help, with food stamps and things like that. So you see the mayor will brag about how he's brought all these jobs to town, but you got to think in terms of quality. There's a guy here in Washington who has got a whole organization called Good Jobs First, and that's what they focus on, is reforming the economic development approach, so you're not just getting quantity, but you're getting quality.
Hmm. Wonderful.
Why do you advocate a mixed agenda, mixed use, mixed income development, rather than something monocultured?
Well, really, there's nothing new to mixed-use development. All we're really doing is getting back to the way communities have been built for the last 10,000 years. You look at almost all the communities in the world, the cities that have lasted for millennia, and you'll find people living on the second story of a building where they operate a store on the ground floor. You don't find this artificial separation that we created with our zoning laws in this country that says, okay, industry over here, commerce over here, residence over here, and end up with communities where people can't walk to shop, they can't walk to, get entertained, they've got no community space. So you get very dysfunctional communities where people don't know their neighbors. And so all we're really doing is getting back to the way things used to be. There's just this current, dysfunctional suburban dead downtown phenomena is very recent. It's not the way things were 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It's just a very temporary aberration. So that's all mixed use is. And you got to be a little careful not to be too arbitrary about it. You got to look at what does this community need. Anything can be abused. Sometimes a place doesn't need more commerce. All it needs is more residences. A lot of the downtown revitalization failures have been because people thought that all they needed was retail and the people would come. And what they found out a year later, when all those retailers were out of business, is that, no, you need customers first. Get the people living downtown. They can survive without a store downtown a lot longer than a store can survive without customers. So get the residences there first, and they'll attract the stores.
What do you see as the role of governments in advancing
Well, a lot of it, you know, traditionally, you know, mayors have, you know, measured their success by their ability to get money from Washington or money from the state or to attract private developers. And those are all useful things. You know, money is critically important to all this. But the thing that most communities need more now is trust. There's just so little trust in government today, trust of government today, that governments find themselves oftentimes unable to do what they want to do even when they're doing the right thing, because nobody really trusts that they're doing it for the right reasons or that they'll actually do what they say they're going to do. So the first thing we need to do is restore trust.
Yeah. How do you suppose we could do that? I mean, I agree with you 100%. I know that's a wide open question. It's just what's going off in my head.
Well, you know, you politicians love to talk about trust and love to talk about principles and visions and all that sort of thing. The only thing that really restores trust is results. You know, they've got to actually do something and show that, yeah, and it doesn't have to be something big. It doesn't have to be something like that mayor in Seoul, you know, tearing out an entire highway and putting in a river. But it needs to be, once again, evidence-based. You know, that if they can just pick a project and do it in a way that properly engages the community, in, you know, in a vision for, you know, what that project should produce for the community, and then actually execute it in a way that's transparent and that produces the results, they'll find their trust coming back. There's really nothing they can do to gain trust other than action.
That can get stopped on, though, because I'm thinking of, like, communities right here in Maine that passed local ordinances that allowed people, for instance, to buy fresh eggs or unprocessed milk or whatever from their local farmers based on trust, and it was working beautifully, but it got stomped on. First from the federal level, and then, of course, the federal level strong-armed the state into stomping on it. How do you deal with the fact that quite often government belongs to the bankers and not to the people?
Well, not just to bankers, but anybody with lots of money.
Yeah, right.
It's the natural result of having an election system that's driven by money.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, when it costs $50 million to get a Senate seat,
yeah,
then there's no way you're going to get a senator in that seat who isn't totally obligated to the people who provided $50 million, and that's not going to be the grassroots. So, you know, they spend over 90% of their time fundraising for the next election or repaying their donors from the last election. So there's no time to really do things that are good for people. But the fact is that all great federal government innovations are, almost all of them, start at the local level. You know, that the idea, the principle, the policy, whatever it is that is adopted, it's usually adopted at the federal level because it worked somewhere at the local level. So cities are the great innovators. So, you know,
that communities or counties that, for instance, ban GMO crops from their, you know, from being grown on their soil, and that gets overridden time after time after time. You know, how do you?
Well, I mean, there's some things that are only going to be fixed, you know, when the system itself is fixed. You know, Monsanto was Bill Clinton's single largest campaign donor, and that's where all this started, was during the Clinton administration, you know, where Monsanto suddenly became like a government agency.
Right.
And, you know, and that was also when the Glass-Steagall Act was killed, which led to basically the money-based takeover of the federal government. So, you know, a lot of this can be traced back to the Clinton administration. So that's just, all we can really do is innovate at the local level and hope that the results inspire politicians at higher levels, you know, the county level, the state level, and eventually the federal level, to adopt it. We can only really lead by example. You know, petitions are wonderful, protests are wonderful, but it's only positive examples that get copied.
I agree. The more people see the better quality of life, the of human relationships and that sort of thing, then, you know, it's going to take off organically. And you're going to have the barriers. You're going to have a lot of people saying, no, we can't do this. But you're going to take away, you know, the jobs that are provided by Monsanto and so on and so forth. But the fact is, you know, that's the way that we can lead to a higher quality of life, in my opinion. How do you see your magazine, Revitalization News, Our Renewed Future, Evidence for Optimism, Resources for Action, as an effective change agent?
Well, it's basically the quickest, easiest way to get this evidence for optimism and these resources for action out to the world at large, or at least right now the English-speaking world, you know, because I can only speak at so many conferences. you know, it's basically a way of replicating what I do on an individual basis as a speaker and consultant, you know, and keeping it fresh. I mean, it comes out on the 1st and the 15th of every month. Every issue has over 100 stories in it, articles, you know, from all around the world. And since each issue has over 100 articles, as time goes on, we're building this huge library. I mean, it's already got almost 1,000 articles in it. They're all keyword searchable. So any student, any leader that wants to do some research on what's working, you know, can just do keyword searches of this huge growing database of information about what's really happening. That's really my role. I mean, I've never really thought of myself as an optimist so much, because I'm so aware of the level of destruction that's taken place on the planet. But for the last 12 years, everybody's come up to me and said, oh, you know, I love your optimistic outlook and all the positive stuff you tell us about. And I finally had to bow to the pressure and call myself an optimist. But that's really, seems to have become my role now, is to find all the good news in the world about restoration, revitalization, and regeneration, and share it with people. And that's what revitalizationnews.com does.
We are running down on time, and I'm wondering if there's some one thought that you'd especially like to leave our listeners with.
I guess the key thing, without sounding, it might sound a bit self-promotional, but what people really need to do is become more aware of just how much of this restoration and regeneration is happening in the world. I mean, it already accounts for somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion a year of activity. And people need to become aware of it, because our regular reports that come from the government, they still just basically measure, you know, new activity, new homes being built, you know, new durable goods being sold. They don't report on all the restoration revitalization. So take a look at revitalizationnews.com and become aware of all this wonderful stuff that's being done around the world, and let it inspire something you can do locally.
Well,
powerful message.
Yes, and I thank you for taking this time to speak to little old us in the midst of what must be a very, very busy speaking schedule.
Well, I love every minute of it. Thank you very much for inviting me, Mary and Burl.
Oh, thank you.
I can sure see why George Oakes, is that how you say his name?
Yes.
Managing director of J.P. Morgan says, Storm Cunningham is the world's thought leader on community revitalization and natural resource restoration.
Well, it was very kind of him to say that. I don't know if it's true.
Well, in any case, thank you very much, and thank you, listeners. How would listeners get in touch with you if they want to learn more or tell you about something that's going on in their community?
Well, my primary site is stormcunningham.com. Mm-hmm. And my email is storm@revitalize.com. That's revitalize without the E on the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. And blessings to you and to all our listeners as we make this kind of restoration, resilience work in our lives.
Thank you. Wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks, yeah. You too.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.